Thank you, Katka. Well, this is actually meant not so much as a presentation, but more as sort of informal concluding remarks, because we're coming to a close of these two very productive, I would say, very, very productive days of discussions. So maybe I should start by thanking everybody for their marvelous presentations in the last 2 days, and also thanking the audience of having the patience and staying with us for such a long time. The presentations, many of them had many layers of details, so I would also recommend to people to maybe try to go back to the written outputs, to some of the papers on which many of these presentations are based. And in some cases, the papers are yet to come out. But in any case, I think the granular level of detail in many of these presentations can only really be communicated from the written papers. So I would encourage everybody who may have been inspired by this workshop to try to look at the output on our website, on our English language website. That's synopsis.cz/en. Now, I would, you know, in these closing remarks, I would like to maybe go back to the, to go back from the details, back to the big picture, so to speak. And in the very beginning, we sort of discussed how we need to understand the political system in China on its own terms, as a Leninist construct. Because looking at the PRC through the prism of standard Western international relations theories, at the end, only serves to normalize this rather extraordinary system. And we can see that to this very day, China often is presented as a state like any other, or almost like any other, perhaps with a few idiosyncrasies, but essentially a state comparable to other states as we know them from our everyday experience. But in fact, I think after these 2 days of discussions, it's becoming increasingly clear, I mean, if it was not clear before, that it's not even a state in the traditional sense of the word, that it's actually a party state. The party that runs that state is, you know, when you think about it, not quite a party, a political party in the sense that we usually understand it either. It's not even a ruling party. It's much more than that. It's something that I've recently started calling for myself a sovereign party, a party that arrogates to itself the sovereignty of a country called the People's Republic of China. Now, this, of course, to many of us may seem like a strange arrangement, but from within that system, from within the Leninist system, from their point of view, it actually makes perfect sense, because the sovereign party, the Communist Party, is the vanguard of the proletariat within a system of the dictatorship of the proletariat, which again is perfectly legitimate because Lenin said so. So when you break down that convoluted sentence, it basically means that the party runs its own dictatorship, and that's the way it should be. And this is, of course, a basic concept, you know, the very substance of Leninism. But I would argue that it actually harks back to even older traditions. And in this context, I think it's perhaps useful to revisit some of the defining disputes of the early Enlightenment, and namely the sort of indirect dispute between Thomas Hobbes and John Locke, who came up with very different notions of sovereignty in their works. And both, as you know, were quite influential, very influential thinkers in their own ways. So these two very different notions of sovereignty are basically the Leviathan and the Constitution. So in Hobbes' Leviathan, the sovereign was identified with might rather than with the law. Law is basically what the sovereign commands, and it cannot limit his power or her power for that matter. The sovereign power is absolute. And I think it was first Hannah Arendt who sort of traced back the intellectual history of totalitarianism back to Thomas Hobbes. Now, the counter argument that in the Western philosophical tradition, of course, was formulated by John Locke, who talked about government by consent that is subject to the law and ultimately to the constitution as the foundational law. So this defining, I would say, debate of the early Enlightenment, some might think was settled by the American and the French revolutions for good, except it wasn't, as we'll see in a little bit. But the French Constitution of 1791 stated explicitly that, quote, sovereignty belongs to the nation. No group can attribute sovereignty to itself, nor can an individual arrogate it to himself, end of quote. Well, we now know that it can, right? The sovereignty can be arrogated to a group or even an individual in some systems. And we only need to look at the Chinese debate on constitutionalism of 2013, which I think was pretty much the last big debate in China. Probably will stay that way for a long time to come. Anyhow, the outcome of that debate was that the Constitution is but a tool to achieve the party's goals. Unlike the bourgeois constitutions in the West, so the Constitution serves a very different role in the Chinese and by extension in all Leninist systems. And in the same line, you know, the concept of Yi Fa Zhi Guo needs to be understood and translated as rule by law rather than rule of law, as is often the case, even in some serious publications. The law is again just a tool for the party to achieve its goals. So in this long roundabout way, what I'm trying to say is that when we consider China's place in the world, we need to keep in mind that we talk about two very different systems derived from two very different philosophical traditions. So it's not just some political differences between the systems in China and in the West. It's just a very it's a very different look. It's a very different way of looking at society and the way society should be organized. It's a fundamental difference that, again, stems from very different systems of thought. And this fundamental difference also affects the very structures of these two, you know, worldviews or world systems, I would even say, including the bureaucratic structures. Institutions that might be at the surface level roughly equivalent in the respective systems often serve very different purposes, and we need to keep that in mind when we talk about them. We need to be mindful of these differences and nuances when we describe the CCP-ruled political system. Things that have the same or similar names in China may not be the same things at all. They may be quite different from the concepts and institutions we're familiar with. We have described this phenomenon with Yichang Lulu as kind of an equivalent of the concept of le faux ami in linguistics, when sometimes you're tempted to translate similarly sounding things with the same notions, but they could be very different, deceivingly different. mechanical translation or transposition sometimes may suggest very misleading interpretations. So, of course, the situation is complicated by the fact that very often the Communist Party of China itself is actively contributing to this confusion by translating the same terms differently in official documents on different occasions. So, you know, we all know that, for instance, the term Zhonghua Renmin Gonghuguo Juxi is translated sometimes, or has been translated for some 30 years as chairman of the People's Republic of China up to 1982. And then the very same term started to be translated as president and has been translated as president ever since. And however we translate this particular term, it is in any case not really equivalent with our understanding of the term president as we, you know, the position as we know it from our systems. Chairman of the People's Republic or president of the People's Republic is just another title of the Secretary General, mostly used for external purposes. So we, you know, we know that the sovereign powers lie elsewhere. They lie with the title of Secretary General, not with the president. And you know, careful observers of China mostly are mindful of these differences in meaning, and they are careful about their choice of words most of the times. But lately, it struck me as very interesting that there has been this, what I consider a persistent mistranslation of one very important term, and namely the exact title of the new security law in Hong Kong. So the Chinese term for the law is Guojia Anquanfa, which gets almost universally translated as national security law. And including in this workshop, we have, you know, for careful listeners, they may have noticed that during some of the presentations, we actually talked about this law as the national security law. Now, the core of that term, the term Guojia Anquan, which would be national security under this translation, is a very loaded term with a very long history. And again, it's a term that has been translated in various official CCP documents, either as national security or as state security, according to the specific situation. Now, I would argue that state security is in no way interchangeable with national security. State security is a very distinct concept that again has been derived from a very different worldview and very different political logic. State security has been derived from the early Soviet practice, namely the need to safeguard the security of the new revolutionary regime, the security of the party, of the Communist Party as the sovereign in the new regime. Or in some periods, the security of party leadership, or maybe even some members of the party leadership, because the very same concept was often used to purge the party leadership. In any case, it's very different from the concept of national security. Felix Dzerzhinsky, the founder of Cheka, which was the first institution in the long line of this state security tradition, famously declared that he was not interested in justice, not even in revolutionary justice. He was only interested in the repression of counter-revolutionaries. And since the very beginning, this new concept of state security was basically a tool of repression, of protecting the security of the vanguard by repressing their political opponents. And this Soviet system was later copied in the Soviet satellites, and it actually survived in some of them, apart from China. Surprisingly, to this day, we actually have a KGB in South Ossetia and also Belarus. Now, what's also interesting is that in China, the nomenclature until recently was actually different. though the functions of the security apparatus have been largely the same. And some of the names applied in China are also quite instructive, because the state security was mostly in the purview in the 30s of an organization called the Political Protection Bureau, or the Central Political Protection Bureau, Zhongyang Zhengzhe Baowei. And then during the war and during the civil war, and something called with a very vague name as the Social Affairs Department, Zhongkong Zhongyang Shehuibu. And then after the creation of the People's Republic in 1949, the state security functions were mostly exercised by the Ministry of Public Security, by the Kungangbu, which is quite interesting, you know, in terms of terminology, because of course in the Soviet Union itself at that time, it was already first the Ministry of State Security and then the Committee of State Security, the KGB. Now the CCP leaders apparently were mindful of the linguistic nuances between public security and state security, and variously emphasized the similarities or differences with the Soviet nomenclature, depending on the widely fluctuating mutual relationship with the USSR. So in April 1958, which was the you know, the beginning of the end of the good relations between the USSR and the PRC, the then minister of public security, Luo Ruiqing, later purged in the Cultural Revolution, remarked that, quote, "Our ministry," meaning the Ministry of Public Security, "safeguards the security of the state, and what the Soviet Union calls the Committee for State Security also safeguards the security of the state." So he finds the functions to be basically identical despite the difference in the name. Yet only 4 years later, after the breakup between the USSR and the PRC, the then party vice chairman, Liu Shaoqi, made the following assertion during a gathering in Beijing. Quote, "Yours are called bureaus of public security, right? The term public security, what does it mean? It means you're in charge of the public tranquility. Who then are the public? They're the people. In the Soviet Union, they speak of the Committee for Security," that would be the KGB. "It stands for the security of the leaders." So it's quite interesting that, you know, after the Soviet, Sino-Soviet split, Liu Shaoqi would emphasize this nominal difference in their approach to security. Of course, in fact, it was the same. You know, the Kungangbu, the Ministry of Public Security, was basically performing many of the functions of the Committee of Public of State Security, the KGB, in the Soviet Union. And then in 1983. China eventually created its own Ministry of State Security. So since that time, since about 1983, there was basically a system of dual ministries for security. There was the Ministry of Public Security and Ministry of State Security, apparently with much overlap, particularly in the issues of state security. And then, as Matt mentioned in his presentation, in late 2013, after Xi Jinping came to power, yet another new organ was created, the Central State Security Commission. Let's translate it that way. Zhongyang Guojia Anquan Weiyunhui. I actually looked back at the coverage of the creation of this committee back in 2013, and then this was in late 2014, so most of the coverage actually came in 2014. And it's quite interesting, because a lot of commentators argued that this new body is actually modeled after the National Security Council in the United States, and accordingly called it the National Security Committee, or even National Security Council. Which is very interesting, because the very same term, Guojia Anquan Weiyunhui, is actually used in Chinese for KGB. And KGB stands for Komitet Gosudarstvennoy Bezopasnosti, the Committee of State Security. So you would think that, also given the overall Leninist background of the political system in China, you would think that most commentators would probably find it closer to the KGB than to the NSC, but they didn't. So at that time, they were arguing it's just like that, just like the NSC in the United States. Now, in July this year, finally, a local branch of this National Security or State Security Committee was established in Hong Kong to enforce the new law. And the new law and all the related enforcing agencies that are coming now to Hong Kong are clearly in the repressive line of the state security concept, not in the line of the national security concept. Yet, in the international discourse, we still have a lot of people talking about national security in Hong Kong, national security law for Hong Kong. Now, is that important? I think it is important. We've already seen cases when some talking heads basically argue that what is the problem here? Everybody has the concept of national security. Everybody has a national security bureaucracy. So what's so different about Hong Kong? Well, I would argue that there is a huge difference, and the tragedy of Hong Kong is that it's not national security that has befallen it, but the state security, unfortunately. So, with these concluding remarks, I would like to again thank everybody for their participation and for their marvelous contributions, and maybe we can ask Professor Lamava to. No, we have a discussion now, right?